This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's 2026. We made it. The new year doesn't require a whole new you, but wouldn't it be nice to feel a little less weighed down? Therapy can help more easily identify all the things that might be holding you back from reaching your goals or being your ideal self. We all have obstacles to overcome. Personally, I'm working on trying not to hold grudges. That's a big one for me. I hang on to grudges sometimes for years. And I know that's probably not the best way to move through life. BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, with over 30,000 fully licensed therapists who have served more than 5 million people around the world. It really works, and it has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. When I'm working on a project, whether it's something for work or around the house, I can sometimes get blinders on, and I just want to finish that project as quickly as possible so I can move on to the next thing. But if I take a step back and prioritize pacing, I can appreciate the act of actually doing the thing instead of just appreciating that it's done. If you're working on a project of your own, say, trying to cure a rage virus in a post-apocalyptic society, or maybe you have an elaborate bone temple that needs to be taken care of, hydration is crucial. Rehydrate in a way that works for you with Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier, which has 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, 8 vitamins and nutrients in every stick, and comes in a bunch of flavors. Liquid IV can help you recharge or prepare for what's coming your way, whether it be hulking zombie-like creatures or a deranged guy named Jimmy. And it's super easy. You just tear the packet open, pour it in your water, mix it up, and that's it. I have to imagine that Dr. Ian Kelson, Ralph Fiennes' character in 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, would appreciate the fact that just 1 stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water actually hydrates better than water alone. Rehydrate with better hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. That's 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at liquidiv.com. Every day, companies you've probably never heard of are making billions of dollars by pulling your personal data off the internet and selling it without your consent. Data brokers are selling your name, address, phone number, and more to marketers, scammers, basically anyone who's willing to pay for it. But Aura helps you fight back. They remove your personal data from broker sites and keep it off, and they alert you quickly if your information shows up in some kind of breach. But Aura is more than just data broker removal. In one simple app, Aura gives you a full digital security suite, including a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager to keep logins safe, and spam call protection to cut off scammers before they can reach you. Aura also scans the dark web for your most sensitive information, like your social security number, bank logins, and passwords, and notifies you instantly if they're exposed. And if your identity does ever get stolen, you're backed by up to $5 million in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support to help you recover quickly. Right now, you can try Aura free for 14 days when you visit aura.com/remove. That is enough time for Aura to start removing your personal information from data broker sites. Sign up today at aura.com/remove to get the peace of mind that your privacy, identity, and finances are safeguarded. That's aura.com/remove. Certain terms apply. See the site for details. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, January 28th, 2026. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll take a trip to Jacob's Trailer Park. We'll talk about the new Chris Pratt film, Mercy. And finally, we'll present some One Battle After Another interviews. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. As is normally the case for late January, there's not a ton happening in the world of film right now. The Sundance Film Festival is in full swing, so we're going to be devoting some time on an upcoming episode to talking about all the stuff that we're watching remotely. Bill Bria had a chance to go to Park City. This is the last year that the festival is going to be in Park City, Utah, so he'll bring us maybe a couple dispatches or something from his adventures there, and Brad Oman and I had a chance to see some stuff that we'll be talking about on a future episode, so stay tuned for that. But just in terms of like movie news, there isn't really a ton that's happening. There's going to be a Senate hearing in February about the Netflix Warner Brothers deal. I'm curious to see if anything meaningful comes from that. Brian Robbins, the former head of Paramount, is launching a new animation company. Shrinking has been renewed for season 4 at Apple TV. And then there are a couple of quotes from the people involved with Star Wars Starfighter and DC's Man of Tomorrow, respectively, that address various aspects of those productions. I'm not going to really get into those because they're not like super, super exciting, but you can read more about them at the links in the show notes. Marvel's new series Wonder Man is apparently very good. I have not had a chance to check it out myself, but I believe all 8 episodes are up on Disney Plus right now. We have a review of the series up at slashfilm.com, as well as a bunch of different articles breaking down the most interesting aspects of that show. So I'm going to link to at least one of those in the show notes. Let's see, what else has happened? Oh, the 2026 Academy Award nominations happened last Thursday, and somehow it feels like it was a million years ago. I can't believe it's been less than a week since that happened. But yeah, as you probably know from just being alive in this country, some pretty big other news eclipsed that this past weekend. So I don't need to get into all of that, but I'm sure everybody knows what I'm talking about. Okay, so let's just say that's it for the news section, right? There's not really a ton going on. So let's jump right now into one of my favorite segments of the show. With me now is Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, I'm so happy that we're doing another Jacob's Trailer Park segment. It's been quite some time since we've done one of these. And
well, we do it every week, Ben, and then it wouldn't be special anymore. It's the reason why it's everybody's most clamored for and favorite segment on the Slash Film Weekly.
That's absolutely right. All right, so yeah, I think we have 6 or 7 trailers to run through here. I'm curious what you made of the trailer for Monarch Legacy of Monsters Season 2. Did you even watch the first season of the show?
No, I did not, and it's because I like the MonsterVerse just fine, but a movie every few years is the right amount of MonsterVerse for me. I don't need the show in this world as often as some people I know do, but I know the folks at the site who like this show really like it. So yeah, I went to this trailer purely as a, will this make me want to watch this show exercise?
Okay, so how did it do?
Looks good. Looks fine. I won't watch it. It's a good trailer. I mean, if I was a fan of, if I was a super fan of the MonsterVerse, I'd be really, really on board for this. It's my main wonder, as somebody who's not seen Season 1, is all the shots of Kong and Godzilla in this trailer, are those like all of the Godzilla and Kong shots in the whole season? I can't imagine each episode having like giant monsters constantly throughout them from a pure budgetary standpoint. I have to imagine this show is like 75% people in rooms, right?
I think so. I watched, I want to say, 2 episodes of Season 1 and then kind of tapped out. So we're swimming in waters where we don't know what's lurking underneath us in this scenario. So maybe people can write in and let us know. But yeah.
In that case, I'll say it's a good trailer. I always like seeing Kurt Russell. It looks very expensive. It looks very much in line with the scope and budget of the movies, which is a very impressive thing. So yeah, I think that it's a 7 out of 10 trailer. It gets the job done. It sells a new threat, but it plays like a movie. Like, I was watching the trailer going, oh, this feels like the next MonsterVerse movie. And then at the end it goes, new season. And I'm like, oh, I'm not going to watch 8 episodes of this, but I'm very happy for those who will.
Yeah, definitely. I noticed that the show stars Anna Sawai, who was really great in Shogun. And I think she was in Season 1, and that was before I watched Shogun and before I really knew who she was as a performer. So that's one thing that maybe people might perk up at who got on the Shogun train like the rest of us did. So yeah, check that out. Next up is Star Wars Maul Shadow Lord, which is an animated series set in the Star Wars universe featuring the return of Darth Maul. Animated Star Wars shows, Jacob, I know are not our forte, really. I mean, we cover some on Slash Film here and there, but I thought this trailer looked pretty cool. What'd you think about it?
Yeah, the people who love animated Star Wars love animated Star Wars, like, so profoundly. This is another Legacy of Monsters situation where I'm so glad the people who love this corner of Star Wars universe are getting more shows. I tried Clone Wars. I tapped out pretty early. People told me I should stick with it. But who's got the time? I've always had a tough time with the animation style of these shows, Ben. Even as the detail has gotten better and the lighting's gotten better since, the early Clone Wars episodes. Like, I watched this trailer and the animation is so much crisper and cleaner and more vibrant than the early Clone Wars stuff that I tapped out of. But I fundamentally do not like the character designs of the animation. And that's been a big reason for why I have not embraced these shows. So yeah, this show looks interesting. I mean, I know Darth Maul or just Maul has had this giant life in Star Wars animation that he has not had, in live action. I'm a guy who I know the basics of Maul because of the nature of my job. I've edited enough articles on Slash Film about where Maul has been since he was cut in half and somehow survived. But this show is not for me. This is made for people who are deeply invested in the anime version of his character, who've watched him, you know, live and actually die. We know this show can't end with him dead because he's died in another show that takes place after this one. So yeah, it's one of those weird situations where it's like, this looks slick, this looks potentially fun. I am not the target audience, but for those of you who are, so happy for you, so glad. 7.5 out of 10 trailer gets the job done.
Nice. Yeah, I didn't even know that that character died. The last I remember him was popping up in live action in the live action Solo movie and like them kind of teasing some sort of bigger story that obviously never really happened with that whole thing. So
he's had such a long, complicated animation history at this point. Like, you can, it's gotten wild. That's it. Somebody, I admire that it happened. I'm happy for people who can follow it, but I just know the basics.
Okay. Well, I'm really curious to know what you made of the trailer for Masters of the Universe, which is one of those movies that I think you and I have been doing this, like been in this industry for about the same time. Like 2009-ish is around when I started. I think you started around the same time, right?
Yeah, 2009 was my first year.
Okay. So I feel like a live action He-Man movie has been one of those things that's just been like a constant in our lives in this line of work. Just like every few years, there's some sort of new creative team who's tried to tackle it, or a new actor who gets attached, and then inevitably it falls apart and doesn't actually happen. They actually made one of these things, Jacob. So what did you think of the trailer for Masters of the Universe?
I hope Travis Knight got a good paycheck so he can make more stop motion. Once again, this is the third time in a row where I don't want to yuck anybody's yum, but I did not grow up with Masters of the Universe or He-Man. I have no nostalgic value for it. I'm so glad that people who love it, but I have to approach this purely from a POV of somebody who knows those characters as iconography and not without knowing any details whatsoever. And I think it may have been you in our company Slack who said that this trailer wishes it was Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. The whole thing just looks weirdly bland. I wished it needed to be more dynamic looking. It needed to, like, sell me, the non-fan, more. It needed to have a better tagline than what it was, like, something along the lines of see how he became He-Man. And I'm like, you're never gonna get around the fact that your character's name is He-Man. You're not gonna get around that. And I can't get over any project where a character's name is He-Man, Ben. I'm sorry to the fans. I'm sorry. Cue your pitchforks. This must be what it's like to watch the trailer for, you know, Avengers Endgame if you were in a coma from 2008-2019.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it just seems so cheap to me, even though it looks like they spent a lot of money on it somehow. So there's like a weird clash in my mind that I can't quite get over. And then just the fact that this movie is coming out in 2026 is kind of mind-boggling. Like, honestly, who cares about a Masters of the Universe film at this point? Like, this feels like something that should have come out in 2012 instead of 2026. So
I'm genuinely wondering if the new animated shows that were on Netflix have gotten new generation interested. Because I know a lot of those shows were pretty well liked by the fans, from what I could tell, but were genuine nostalgia plays, like playing for fans who were 40 years old. I do not know if there are younger He-Man fans. I would love to know. Like, if you're a parent listening to the show and your kids love Masters of the Universe, absolutely let us know. But from afar, I think that this needed to look funnier or more dynamic or more interesting. It feels like a movie that would have been made in 2012, Ben. Doesn't feel like a 2026 movie.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's move to I Love Boosters, which is Boots Riley's new movie. He's the director of... oh, God, what was the name of his first film?
Sorry to bother you.
Yes, thank you. Sorry to bother you. You know what's really embarrassing about that, Jacob? I'm quoted on the poster for Sorry to Bother You, and I could not remember the name of the movie. I'm leaving this in the podcast. Okay, so Boots Riley, I Love Boosters is the movie. It comes out in theaters on May 22nd. What did you think about this teaser?
Yeah, this is a really effective teaser. I I guess I kind of didn't have this one on my radar. I knew a new Boots Riley film was coming. I didn't know the premise. But this trailer is really in your face and colorful. And it's a really great cast. So we're all seem to be really going for it in pretty big ways. And I like that. It looks like a heist movie. The premise here is that it's about a group of women who are stealing high-end clothing to resell it and essentially make a profit. But it seems to be an element of class warfare on display here. I like Boots Riley's whole thing is like, he's not going to make a movie that's just a heist movie. So already in this trailer, you can see the social commentary leaking through the end here. This is going to be, if it's anything like his past work, this is going to be like really fun, but really acidic. And I like that you can already feel that here. This trailer is a blast to watch, but it also, you know, makes it clear that this is not just a comedy. This is a new Boots Riley movie. And you're either going to probably love it or hate it, but it's going to be something unique and special. So yeah, this is a 9 out of 10 trailer. I went from being like, oh, a new Boots Riley movie to having I Love Boosters on my radar.
Awesome. Okay, so what did you think about the trailer for Daredevil Born Again Season 2?
All right, this is the fourth time in this segment where I'm going to yuck people's yum. I know Charlie Cox's Daredevil has so many dedicated fans. People love this take on the character. They are really invested in it. I tapped out the original Netflix show. I watched Born Again and said, oh, this is actually pretty good, but didn't get around to fish. I did not feel invested, even though I recognize that the first season of Born Again, from what I watched, was actually a good show. It had worthwhile stuff going on. I just couldn't find the energy to fully invest myself in another Marvel TV show at this point. So this trailer's fine. I mean, the whole drawing point here is that Jessica Jones is back. Speaking of characters, like, I love Charlie Cox as Matt Murdock. Don't always love his shows. I loved Jessica Jones. But that was another show that went from having one of the best first seasons in Marvel to having a really fast drop off. Is it enough to get me into season two or to get caught up? I don't think so. Like I said, I'm really happy for the fans. I'm really happy for people who are invested. I'm glad you're getting this. The one shot of Foggy Nelson reminded me of why I stopped watching the original show. One of the worst performances of any major comic book character I've ever seen. It would be a 7.5 out of 10, but I'm knocking down a 6.5 because Foggy Nelson's in it for one shot.
That's one of the funniest takes of yours, Jacob, that you just like hate the guy, the performance of the Foggy Nelson actor. It's so funny to me.
He's a terrible actor. Foggy Nelson is one of the great Marvel supporting characters. And the 2003 Daredevil movie is bad, but it nailed the casting. Jon Favreau in 2003 is the ideal Foggy Nelson. And this guy is no 2003 Jon Favreau, Ben.
Okay. Now that person has been dead and buried on this podcast, let's move to the Super Mario Galaxy movie. There's a new first look for this, and it, introduces the character of Yoshi here. So I know that I think you and I shared a similar reaction to the original Super Mario Brothers movie, the animated one from a couple years ago, which was like, it looked really pretty, but it was like the most basic, safe possible version of that story. So I'm not sure if we can really glean very much plot wise here, but what do you make of the introduction of Yoshi here?
Yeah, well, after a whole segment of me saying not my fandom, this is my fandom in terms of original Mario stuff. I love the Mario iconography. I love these characters. I love the world. I love the sound effects and the music. And one thing the first movie did really well was the way it rendered all this familiar video game iconography and gameplay elements into like the cinematic, into a cinematic way where watching going, it wasn't just Leonardo DiCaprio pointing. I recognize that meme. It was, it really felt like a real beautiful recreation of video game ideas in a cinematic format in terms of visuals and sounds. Listening to that movie and watching that movie on mute, great experience. But as you said, the script of the first one could not have been a weaker thing. It is the safest, dullest, least risk-taking exercise imaginable. It is brand management. Nintendo clearly let Illumination go hog wild on visuals, but probably put all kinds of bumpers on what that script could entail. So I'm going this trailer once again in 2 minutes of footage, like, oh, here are characters I love, here are sound effects I love, here are costumes and locations that I love. I love they're dipping into not just Super Mario Galaxy, but it's a lot of Super Mario Odyssey in this trailer, and that's great. Odyssey is one of my favorite games of all time. And Yoshi. Yoshi's very cute, although putting Yoshi into a narrative is going to require some flexing because The number of times I have killed a Yoshi in a Mario game to get to an impossible reach barrier is innumerable. So I need to get around Yoshi being a character who dies 1,000 times every Mario game. That said, as you can see, I'm very excited about the visuals of this. But then Mario opens his mouth and it's Chris Pratt's bad Mario voice. And I remember the script, the original one. But as a trailer, as a collection of images of things that I like, beautifully recreated, it's an 8 out of 10 trailer for probably a 4 out of 10 movie, Ben.
Nice, yeah. Okay, I don't necessarily have huge high hopes, but the bar was set so low by that first animated film that maybe the only way to go is up. Fingers crossed, we'll see. All right, last trailer here is for Lee Cronin's The Mummy, and that's actually the full title of the movie. I think legally they have to call it that. It's kind of a Lee Daniels the Butler type of situation for our people who've been reading Slash Home for a long time and remember that film. So what do you think about this one?
I really liked Lee Cronin's previous movie, Evil Dead Rise. I stand by that as being a top-tier Evil Dead movie. And the idea of him doing anything else is really exciting. Bring it on. I know there's some weird internet buzz going on about this movie having bad test screenings. I don't know how much truth there is to that. But this trailer rules, Ben. This trailer is so scary and so strange. And the way it kind of mixes media formats and the way it kind of dances around the edges of what's going on is utterly spectacular stuff. And Lee Cronin having his name in the title, you know, means it means it's either going to be like a calling card for him, the way John Carpenter, you know, would put his possessive on movies, or it's going to be a bad joke in a few years when his movie's terrible. But this is a great trailer. This is a really exciting trailer that had me went from being like, oh yeah, Lee Cronin's new horror movie, I'm interested, to being, oh man, put this on a screen in front of me right now. This is a 9 out of 10 trailer.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about this. It seems like he's taking a very unconventional approach to a mummy story. I think the mummy is going to be effectively like a little girl in this movie, which is not really an approach that I've seen before. I know you're big into Universal horror and probably you've seen maybe every mummy movie. Is that fair to say? Like there's been a lot.
Who knows how many mummy movies there are, Ben? I've seen my fair share. And yeah, the idea here, you know, definitely seems to be a little girl has carried some kind of curse back with her, as opposed to maybe being a literal mummy, which ironically is the ending of the terrible Tom Cruise mummy movie. If you remember that, Ben, where it ends with the evil mummy being destroyed, but Tom Cruise is now cursed. Now he's the mummy for the future sequels never got made.
My God, I actually never saw that movie and didn't realize that's how it ended. That's like, that's equal parts tragic and hilarious to me.
Ben, then you haven't seen the ending of the movie where Tom Cruise, now a resurrected, undead, immortal mummy warrior, is walking through the desert with his best friend, played by Jake Johnson, who died in Act One, but has been acting as like a ghost of America, like a ghost like assistant through most of the movie, and now he's walking around in the flesh. And he says to Tom Cruise, I could be misremembering this, but I swear to God, this is what he says. He says, thanks for resurrecting me, bro.
Why is that not a major meme? That needs to come back in a big way.
I could be wrong. In my memory, it's thanks for resurrecting me, bro. But there absolutely is a line of dialogue where he thanks Tom Cruise for resurrecting him from the dead.
Excellent. All right. Well, we don't have much longer to wait to see Lee Cronin's The Mummy that hits theaters on April 17th. Thanks very much, Jacob. I appreciate it. Where can people find you online if they want to track you down?
Doing what I can, slashfilm.com, running that show. If you have a complaint, you know, blame me. And Trekking Through Time and Space, my podcast, where I work with former Slash Film editor Hoi Chin Bui to talk about Star Trek and Doctor Who.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, Jacob. I'm joined now by Slash Film staff writer Jeremy Mathai.
Hey, folks. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Absolutely, Jeremy. I have you here for a very, very special reason, and that reason is I gave myself the gift of not caring about the new Chris Pratt movie, Mercy, and you actually sacrificed your time and effort as part of your job at Slash Film to see this film and review it. I'm going to link to your review in the show notes. But I want to, first of all, just thank you for your service because you're doing very, very important work.
Yes, I took the bullet for us all on this one.
And then basically, I just wanted to have you on so you can tell me about this movie because I've heard it's terrible, Jeremy. And maybe our listeners, some of whom might have seen the film, many of whom I'm guessing didn't, might just enjoy hearing from somebody who's actually sat through it what they thought about this thing.
Yeah, in this case, I'm going to implore our listeners to read my review and make my sacrifice worth it, because this really was hard to sit through. I'm not going to hold back here. I'm probably going to go full spoilers, only because so few people have probably seen this. And honestly, if you're, for whatever reason, on the fence about this, hearing how insane this movie is might make it more worth watching for some people. So if so, you're welcome. And I apologize both at the same time. But yes, this movie is just a really, really bad movie. If I remember correctly, way back when the first trailer for this dropped last year, one of our Slash Film writers read a whole thing about how, yeah, this has the makings of being the worst movie of 2026. And while it is too early in the year to say that definitively, I think it's pretty likely this is going to end up on a lot of worst of lists by the time it's all said and done. It is just, it's exactly what the trailers kind of pitch it to be. It is Chris Pratt sitting in a chair for basically the entire runtime of this movie and yelling very unconvincingly, mind you, at Rebecca Ferguson as this AI judge. And Chris Pratt plays this cop named Chris Raven. He's an LAPD cop who's apparently, like, he's one of the people responsible for this futuristic tech in the first place, where every capital crime is decided by this AI judge who's presiding over everything. It's just one-on-one. You're in this sci-fi world, you're guilty until proven innocent. That's pretty much the extent of this movie's imagination as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the movie is just him. For whatever reason, it forces the alleged criminal to defend themselves by looking at every piece of evidence available. Like, there's no such thing as conflict of interest in this world, I guess. It's just the person gets to be their own lawyer and just go through reams of evidence. You know, it's a screen life movie, so everything is digital. Everything's on this one screen that he's looking at for almost the entire movie. And, I mean, if you've seen, like, Missing or Searching, those two really, really, you know, those are probably two of the best screen life movies out there, where everything takes place mm-hmm. on this computer screen. John Cho is, you know, he's like moving a mouse icon to show you, kind of like direct your eyes where you need to look on the screen, all this information being presented. This movie does none of that. So you're kind of just like aimlessly looking at the screen that Chris Pratt is looking at, as you're just bombarded with all this information just coming at you. Video clips, doorbell cameras. Like, this movie really goes, it really kind of strains its premise trying to find all this evidence of Chris Pratt's character murdering his wife, which he doesn't remember for reasons that aren't explained in the movie. So you're just kind of like hanging in there waiting to see where this all goes and why he's
like...
Wait a second.
It's never actually explained? It's not a reveal late in the story?
You spend probably the first hour or so wondering why he doesn't seem to be aware of what's going on. He's just kind of angry and befuddled for most of that, at the beginning of the movie. There is kind of a throwaway line towards the end where it's like, oh yeah, he was drugged or something to that extent, which kind of like hand waves it away. But like, it's just a maddening watch. Nothing is presented in any like narrative storytelling sense, where you're, you know, kind of sitting here and like, you know, sort of seeing how the movie progresses and staying ahead of the characters or kind of preserving the mystery as it goes on. It is a total, total slog. And the worst thing of all is it'll be headache inducing to certain viewers like myself, because like I said, there's no sense of why information is coming at you and the way it's being presented. You're going from eyeline to eyeline as new videos are thrown across the screen. And it really is not just the 3D that this movie is presented in, for whatever reason, because I still can't figure that part out, but it is just a very visually, very visually chaotic watch. I'll put it that way.
Man, it sounds like, yeah, just a total assault on the senses. I didn't realize it was in 3D. That sounds terrible. Jeremy, when I first saw this trailer, I was like, okay, this is just Minority Report for dumbasses, basically. It's kind of like what it looked like. So when you're watching the movie, is the tone of it taking itself seriously like Minority Report, or is it trying to have fun and it's just the fun is kind of overtaken by the visual chaotic nature of what's going on? Or like, tonally, what's happening here?
Yeah, that was the thing going in. I was at least hoping for sort of a fun, bad watch in the same vein as like Morbius, Madame Web, you know, those kinds of movies where it's like very object, like they kind of self-aware about how like nonsense it is, but they're still having fun at the same time. This is very much trying to be like this uber serious commentary on AI and cop brutality and that sort of thing. And it just doesn't work whatsoever. It is trying way too hard. There's no, like, I was at least hoping for like some sort of like a RoboCop-esque kind of take on this where it's more satire than anything else. This movie just has no grasp of tone, and it almost accidentally ends up circling back to being pro-AI and pro-cop by the end of it, where like in general that's probably not a great idea, but releasing this movie at this point of time just makes it feel so much more misguided than it actually than it already is.
Honestly, I'm not surprised that it's a little muddled, because it comes from Timur Bekmambetov, who is the director of this. He is the guy who really kind of shepherded that whole Screen Life mini movement, if you want to call it that, into theaters. And he's been like a producer on Unfriended and Searching and Missing and those kinds of movies. And so this is like his first movie back in 5 years, I think. And I guess that that kind of Chris Pratt sitting in a chair watching stuff on screens is his way of trying to like make that maybe a little bit more action friendly or like more cinematic and kind of tie it back into some of the stuff that he did previously as a director, because he directed films like Wanted and like the Day Watch and Night Watch movies. I don't know if you remember those from mid-2000s. So, and I forgot he directed Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. but he's directed like what I would call traditional action movies before. And kind of like Robert Zemeckis, he's just become enamored with this technology, and it kind of seems like he's gotten lost in that a little bit. But I know you and I share a love of action movies. So is there any actual action in this film aside from the stuff that's on the videos? Like, does Chris Pratt ever leave the chair at any point? Like, how would you categorize the action components of this movie?
Yeah, so in the trailer, they do show, like, glimpses of action. Like, there's a car chase. Again, still told through the dash cam of a cop car. So that's kind of how it gets around that sort of thing. And I will spoil that towards the end of the movie, Chris Pratt does actually get up from the chair, which is, you know, after going through an hour and 20 minutes of just, you know, this repeated nonsense going on, that does feel kind of like that woke me up a little bit. I was like, all right, here we go. He's finally up from the chair. And from that point on, the movie kind of plays fast and loose about its Screen Life gimmick in the first place. Like, some shots are still through like security cams or, you know, that sort of thing. And then abruptly in the conclusion, where he's figured out the real person who set him up for this murder in the first place, it cuts to like normal, you know, narrative filmmaking shots of, you know, him in the middle of this fight. And it just abandons the gimmick completely. And I'm just sitting there like, you couldn't even like do us the courtesy of like committing wholesale to the Screen Life gimmick in the first place. You just play fast and loose with your own rules at this point. And I just kind of threw my hands up in the air and I was like, all right, this is, I'll watch this once for my, you know, professional duties and forget that this ever happened ever again. This is, this is quite the movie, Ben. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. Is there anything else that stood out to you? It sounds like there's probably not much good about this movie at all, but anything that was laughably bad or made you roll your eyes extra hard?
One thing that stands out, just because currently I'm making my way through Peaky Blinders, a rewatch of Peaky Blinders right now, and that show stars Annabelle Wallace as, especially in the early seasons, as this kind of equal to Cillian Murphy's character. And Annabelle Wallace plays Chris Pratt's murdered wife in this. And let me tell you, Ben, this movie invents like whole new depths to the level of like the thankless dead wife role. Like, she is given absolutely nothing. There's one sequence that kind of like recreates, like digitally recreates a scene of a party at her home before her murder. So she gets a chance to like walk around and host a party and like make small talk with people. And you're just like, but the movie has no interest in her whatsoever. It's not its greatest sin. There's so many worse things going on, but it's like, man, what a waste of everybody's time. Rebecca Ferguson, Annabelle Wallace, Callie Rice from Night Country, True Detective Night Country, the last season. She gets like a supporting role as a partner to Chris Pratt's cop character. She's kind of like investigating the scenes, and he's kind of like looking at the scenes through her eyes. It is just a waste of everybody's time. It's so bleak.
Man, that seems like they took that from Minority Report as well. The whole midwife thing, and like I feel like that's the movie that kind of maybe didn't invent that, but kind of helped popularize that idea as being like something that's worthy of parody, like the kind of like a first person cam of like the wife running down the beach and laughing and smiling and like trying to turning around and reaching back at the protagonist and all of that. So it sounds like this movie couldn't even get that part right from the ripoff of Minority Report. But all right, well, yeah, once again, I thank you for your sacrifice, Jeremy. And I genuinely do hope that everyone listening to this clicks on your review and reads it, because this podcast is just a side thing. We really need people to actually read the stuff on slashfilm.com to help us keep our jobs and keep being able to go out and make terrible sacrifices like this. So there we go. All right, well, thanks very much, Jeremy. Where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter under Jeremy Mathai. I'm not as active as I probably would like to be, but given the state of everything these days, how could you possibly blame me? I write on slashfilm.com. You can check out my articles, reviews, interviews there. Thank you for not letting my sacrifice be in vain, everybody out there, and be safe.
You got it. All right. Thanks, Jeremy. Okay, I'm going to try something a little bit different for the final segment of today's episode. I hope everyone by now has seen One Battle After Another, the incredible new movie from Paul Thomas Anderson, came out last September. It's streaming on HBO Max. It's also available on physical media on 4K, Blu-ray, and DVD as of about a week ago. If you've not seen the film, I highly encourage you to pause this episode, go check it out, and then come back and listen to the rest of this, because it's going to get into some details about what happens about an hour-ish into the movie. So last Friday, I published an oral history at slashfilm.com of what I think is One Battle After Another's best scene, which is not the amazing car chase that comes at the end of the film, which is incredible for sure, but it's the moment where, or series of moments, where Bob Ferguson, who's played by Leonardo DiCaprio, tries to find his missing daughter, Willa, who's played by Chase Infinity, and he visits Willa's martial arts instructor, Sensei Sergio St. Carlos, who's played by Benicio del Toro. And this set piece is unbelievable. It starts when Bob goes to visit Sensei at the dojo, and he tries to enlist Sensei to help him out, and Sensei very calmly realizes that some shit is going down. There's a big protest happening outside that Sean Penn's character, Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw, has incited. And all of this chaos is happening. And Sensei basically grabs Bob, takes him under his wing, puts him in the car, and drives across town while this protest is going on. And we weave through this really cool connected apartment set. There's a trap door involved at one point. We go into Sensei's apartment where Bob finally gets phone access and is able to call up somebody named Comrade Josh to try to get through and get the coordinates of where his daughter Willa is being taken by the revolutionary group that Bob was a part of decades before. And so there's this amazing comedic clash over the phone that these two characters have. And then Bob ends up splitting up with Sensei and going to the roof. And he tries to follow these skateboarder guys across a gap in two buildings. And Bob, of course, does not make the jump because he's not nearly the revolutionary that he once was. So he crashes through a tree, hits the ground, kind of stumbles, gets up a little bit, and then is almost immediately tased by the police and arrested. So that's the scope of this scene that I asked three of the people who worked on this movie about. So I spoke with Florencia Martin, who is the production designer of the movie. I talked to Andy Jurgensen, who's the editor, and I spoke with Michael Bowman, who is the cinematographer. I'm not going to play you all of those interviews because they're very long, but I am going to play just a couple of segments from those conversations in that order. So Florencia, Andy, and Michael, you'll hear them in that order. And this is just a little bit of a taste of what you can read in that full oral history, which is a much, much deeper exploration of this scene with a bunch of cool details. This is really just like a couple minutes of these conversations that I had. So I wanted to tease you all with a little bit of this audio and encourage you to go read this piece. Please share it with your friends if you know anybody who liked One Battle After Another. please send it to them. This is the type of piece that takes a lot of effort to put together, and it's kind of a risk for a site like Slash Film to devote this many resources to putting a piece together like this, but I really like how it turned out, and I would love to keep doing stuff like this. The only way I'm going to be able to do that is if you all read it, you know? So I'm playing just a little segment here. Hopefully this will entice you to read it, check it out, share it with as many people as you know, put it on your socials. Anything you can do to help me out, I think will help lead to more of these types of stories in the future, and I would be very grateful for your support in that. So here are segments of my conversation with Florencia Martin, Andy Jurgensen, and Michael Bowman.
So the sequence was scripted that Bob meets Sensei, and they go to Sensei's apartment, which is all interconnected with his family that leads to his bachelor pad. So we had that foundation. We went scouting for the film for over 2 years throughout California and landed in El Paso and walked into the perfumery store, which became the anchor of all of Sensei's story. So we arrived to the perfume shop. You know, we're in a city that doesn't get normal filming. So everyone was very welcoming, very curious to what we were doing. And we explained the story and something, you know, can we poke around this building? And we said, absolutely. So we go up the stairs that led to this interesting passageway to the building next door, which was completely gutted on the second floor and had one trap door that led to the bag shop below. And so that was the like genesis, which is funny because it's called Perfumery Genesis, of how we created that labyrinth that starts at the dojo, which we recreated in an empty storefront two blocks down as Sensei's dojo. And once it was a very deeply collaborative process between the actors, Paul and myself and our set decorator, because once Benicio landed in El Paso and walked through the sets, his inspiration also started brewing. So he says, we got to the dojo. And he's like, okay, well, I would call my family to let them know what's happening. And that is kind of the small example of the incredible way that we worked on this film, which was when, by the time we got to the perfume shop, we strongly felt that that was his family's store and that his apartment would just be right above because it's a bit of a front. And then we cast the actual people that worked in that store as his family. So Minisa goes in and is like, Maricela, you're working the cash register. You're closing up the shop, and starts like orchestrating all these people in the natural way that they worked because we got there at closing time. So we started seeing the way they pull things off the sidewalk and close the gates. And so this very like beautiful, energetic way of working.
I would love to know about the phone call between Bob and Comrade Josh, because I don't know if I laughed harder at any other point in the movie than that. So tell me about cutting for comedy. And I'm sure there are a million different ways that scene could have come together. From your perspective, what was it like to put that together, and how many different iterations did you have? All of that stuff.
Well, we had a few, I think. So we watched dailies during the shoot, like communally. So we kind of had our favorite takes, I think, just from what the script supervisor had circled from when Paul was there on the set. And I remember we just like watched kind of some of just the raw dailies of Leo. And there was like two takes that were the best, you know, he loved them. We got really good laughs in the room. And so we kind of stuck to these two. And we usually don't do two cameras, but we actually did have like a front angle and like a side angle of Bob for a lot of that stuff so that we could kind of cut between if we needed to. And then Josh on the other end of the phone was like there live. So that helped the performance. You know, it wasn't just like reading against some other actor or like, you know, script supervisor or something. So we were able to use that recording as well from Josh to use, you know, and play back and forth. Yeah, I mean, the one, you know, going back to like the overcutting thing, like that was like a section where it's like you want to find like lengths of time that you can kind of stay on Leo and like squeeze as much like humor out of before you have to cut, you know, instead of like cutting to all these different angles or cutting to different takes. It just feels manipulated again. You know, so it's like you don't want to be cutting to the front and the side and the front and the side and all these things because it just feels too, there's too much cutting. So you kind of have to stay with the front angle for like a little while. And then there was a point in which we decided, okay, we're going to move to the side angle when Benicio sits down with the gun and it's kind of like doing all of his stuff. Like that was kind of what was fun too. We were able to use all the fun like stuff that Benicio was doing in silence on the other side of the room, kind of as ways to like manipulate the timing to make things like play better, which was kind of fun. And then I remember we threw in that when he goes in the bathroom and he's like, "What time is it?" And he says 8:15, and we were like, "Okay, I hope that gets a laugh." And it got a laugh in one of our screens. So like, okay, that was good. So, you know, you're just trying things.
Yeah.
And you had to be comfortable with the uncomfortable. Like as a cinematographer, you're like, okay, well, we got to really get this light right and give them the thing. But you know, the beauty of it is by this point in the story, you really had, you know, you knew who the hell Bob was. You know who these characters, and it didn't take long. Everyone's very familiar with Benicio, so Sensei's character, everybody knows. And so then you can start really playing with like silhouette and things like that. And that was something we also were able to really explore when they run across the rooftop and all that, and they're just running in silhouette because it's like the skateboarders have their own unique look. Bob obviously has his crazy look, and you just need to see a few beats where you actually have light on their face, and then you can really tell the story of a silhouette and all the chaos that's going on behind them, which is just, you know, the madness of the world. And, you know, and one of my favorite shots in the film is like just that one where the skateboarders come up next, you know, they're in the car and he comes up next to him. He's like, "What's up?" He's "World War III out there, man." And then he's like, "All right, meet me at Genesis." And they drive and you get the shot of all the skateboarders turning, you know, panning with them as they all kind of go around the corner. And it's just kind of this.
So good.
Again, it's like silhouettes and texture, and that was the whole key to the thing.
Yeah, you know? Man, I love it so much. So before I forget, I want to make sure that I have time to ask you
about
the moment where DiCaprio's character jumps off the roof and falls and hits the tree and all of that. Can you walk me through how that happened, how much of it was Leo, how much of it was a stunt guy, all of that?
Yeah. I mean, so Leo had a really great stunt double. His name was Levi. And so what it was you know, we had the tree and there was a tree that was actually growing there on the location. It was like, "Oh, this is cool. Let's maybe can play with this a bit." Cause we had a couple different concepts for how he would escape. And, you know, we looked at some other locations, but it always kept coming back to the tree. And so what it was that there was a thing called a descender rig, which is a stunt rig that hangs off of a crane. And so Levi was on that and he ran, he did the jump and then he could fall and they could slow the rig down really quickly. Like, so he could fall a lot of ways and whoop, they hit the brakes. And so they did that. And then it kind of cut. Okay. And then Leo, and then, you know, obviously, you know, remove all that. And then Leo just kind of got up from there. It was, you know, set up, try to keep the camera, we kept the camera position the same. Leo kind of gets up, runs in, you know, runs towards camera. We have all the chaos going on in the background. Turns, and then we did with Leo, we did that run, his turn, and then we had a stunt pad and he kind of faked getting tased and fell. But we did another version with Levi doing it with no stunt pad so we could get a complete fall, and then they just kind of do a little stitch of the whole thing as the fall's happening, and then added the taser lines that hit him. Those were digital that hit him. And then also we had shot a pass of like the cop cars coming through and going down and chasing people down the road and all that kind of stuff. And so it was one of these things where it's just like a combination of stuff. I wish I could say that it was like, "Oh my God, we have the whole thing storyboarded and went flawlessly." I mean, you know, there was really very little storyboarding, if any, on this movie. And it was really more about like, you know, having Andy, the editor there. And we, you know, this is the sequence and he could kind of, we'd shot it over a series of nights because we always had other things we had to shoot during those nights. And so Andy could cut stuff together and we could see it and he could kind of comp things and see, okay, cool. Yeah, this is going to work. Let's do this and do this and do this.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the show. You can find more about some of the stories we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will link to them in the show notes, including the big full oral history piece. So you can check it out easily just by clicking the link right there. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out patreon.com/popculture to hear more from many of the folks you heard on this episode. We have a free feed that has effectively the water cooler episodes that we used to do here. over at Pop Cultured. So you can check that out on Apple or Spotify. You can get access to that free feed just by searching for it in those apps. But if you'd like access to exclusive episodes that you won't hear anywhere else, and ad-free episodes, I should add, join us over at patreon.com/popcultured. You can send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us here at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. I know I say it all the time, but it truly does help us. And tell your friends about the show if you can. I'd really appreciate that too. Anything you all can do to help spread the word about the show is greatly appreciated. All right, that's it. Thanks, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.